Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show, where we explore the origin and nature of human consciousness, the science of the soul, ancient metaphysics, modern physics, social and political issues. I'm coming to you from Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, or actually south of Ottawa in a smaller town. And the show's been, we're in our fourth year of the Zero Point Radio Show. The aim is to explore mystical and esoteric teachings and relate these to science. And we explore different areas particularly, including the psychology of consciousness, the relationship of modern physics to ancient metaphysics, the issues of evolution, and considered evolution not only from a physical point of view in terms of evolution of the physical man or woman, but also in terms of evolution of a human being attaining higher levels of realization through their own spiritual attainments. So the idea of evolution. So consciousness, metaphysics, and evolution are the main areas that we explore. I now have in front of me an absolutely beautiful edition of my primary book called The Heart Doctrine, Mystical Views of the Origin and Nature of Human Consciousness. And my book is now available throughout the States through Amazon and can be ordered online or through any bookstore. And this is an absolutely beautiful edition of this book. On the cover, I have this inspired painting by Rasuli, an American artist in California. And you can see his work at his site, www.rasuli.com. And the title of this picture that's on the front of the Heart Doctrine is called The Veiling of the Soul. And what it shows is like six angels in a way joined hands around in a heart shape around a seventh angel in the center. It's a really very beautiful picture. And that's set off in these pinks and purples and mauves and so do have a look at the Heart Doctrine. It's a beautiful image on the front cover. And for me in my life, I look back and it was about 25 years ago when I was a professor at university. I published a little magazine called Mystical Views of Consciousness, the Spirit, Soul, and the Universe. And it was kind of my first one of my earlier attempts at exploring mystical teachings and the issues of consciousness and such. And I look now and the book, The Heart Doctrine, is kind of the culmination of that starting point. And it's a culmination of the 25 years of studies of trying to understand the issues of human consciousness. And the Heart Doctrine is really a profound teaching and a profound concept, and it's hard for people to appreciate its significance and what is really said by when I use that term. See, in modern science, scientists for the past century have denied the existence of the human spirit or soul, and we've denied the idea that there's a vital element in the human being. Instead, human beings became regarded as material biological beings that evolved through Darwinian and neo-Darwinian evolution, but that human beings didn't have any spirit or soul within them. And this has been essentially the dogma of education and science over the past century. And this viewpoint, it's not that it has been established with scientific certainty, but rather it is, as Jim, my co-host, describes it, the idea of the spirit or soul has been banished from modern science. So it's like there's a lost science of the soul, And this is the kind of original psychologies instead of all the multitude of kind of modern psychologies, all of which have value in different domains. But it's like the most important psychology of consciousness and the psychology of the spirit and soul has been ignored through the past century. Instead, we've assumed that human beings, that consciousness in a human being is produced by the brain and that it's centered in the head. And that is where we think the mind is, as though human beings have only one mind. I remember Gurdjieff saying, he says, man's principal mistake is he thinks he only has one mind. Really, he has seven minds, seven aspects to self, seven aspects of mind. And only one of them is centered in the cerebral cortex, which we take to be the mind. In a way, in the human being, we have different minds or aspects to ourselves. So the heart doctrine explores the idea that a human being actually does have an original I, or a unified element, or entity or quanta within themselves. This is the ancient mystical teaching, that there is some divine spark or a monad or jiva atma or a spark, a God spark within the human being, and that this is related to the higher dimensions of the human heart, because the influences of this divine spark are brought down into the human heart. So in mystical views of the origins of consciousness, the first idea is that it originates out of the human heart instead of being produced by the brain in the head. And that the brain of in the head and the minding and the thinking in the brain in the head, that is all secondary to the nature of self within the heart. And the self within the heart, it brings life into the material body through the generation of the heartbeat. And the soul energies are infused into the body through the breathing and the flow of the blood. So a human being is ensouled through the physics of the heart. And there's actually a higher dimensional physics to the human heart. So I would say on one level there's a physical heart, the physical organ that we can see and move about. Then I would say there's a psychical heart, and then a spiritual heart center, and then ultimately a divine spark. The human heart, in a way, exists within four of the worlds described by Kabbalists. And those are the words of emanation, creation, formation, and the world made. Similarly, man has a divine nature, a divine spark, and then that is brought down into a spiritual self and a spiritual spark. And then that is brought down to underlie the psyche, the psyche in the world of formation. And then finally in the world made is the physical heart. So that the heart really is something that has a higher dimensional physics to it. Now, if you remove the heart, the higher dimensional physics, that still exists, even though it's not embodied in that physical heart. But it doesn't end the life of the higher dimensional physics or the higher dimensional heart. So in the heart doctrine, in a way, what it does is it provides an alternative model of the structure and nature of human existence. In a way, what I've done is taken esoteric teachings about the nature of the heart, and I've tried to relate this to an understanding of modern science and physiology and physics and so on. And the Heart Doctrine is really an astonishing book, and it develops these arguments very systematically by going through Western psychologies, and it introduces the idea that we have zero-point centers. I say that human beings actually have a zero-point center, which is a point, which is a center in the higher dimensions of the quantum vacuum, in a sense. and that we have these higher dimensional centers, and that there are bodies that form around these centers. And so we're brought down into different planes of material existence. But there's a whole higher dimensional in physics within the human being. And that's what I try to explore in the Heart Doctrine, as in my other writings. So I think this is a treasure of modern esoteric occult studies and modern science. So I do urge listeners, please look on the internet, go to Amazon, or go to your local bookstore and ask for The Heart Doctrine by Christopher P. Holmes. Okay, you can also read about chapters of The Heart Doctrine at my website at zeropoint.ca. Okay, thank you. So that's a little bit of commercial for The Heart Doctrine book. So I'd like to move on and introduce my co-host, James Moffat from Toronto, Ontario, who's been a lifelong or 30-year-long friend and co-adventurer in our studies of esotericism and science and such. Jim, how are you today?
Fine. How are you, Chris? I don't want to make you feel old, but I actually realized the other day. I think we've known one another a long time.
Oh yeah, but close to 40.
I think it's 44 years actually.
Oh yeah, really? Wow.
Amazing. Everything that I think happened 5 years ago happened 15 years ago now.
Yeah.
You know, that age where you think, well, it's just a couple of years ago. Wait, 10, you know. But yeah, and it was 1976 when you were in graduate school at the University of Waterloo and I was in graduate school at Carleton University that we got interested in the fourth way, Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and yeah, so I mean that's 34 years, and it's very interesting that 34 years later now the Heart Doctrine is in print, which is the Heart Doctrine itself is that work has been the genesis of that work is probably about 30 years ago, and
definitely
25 years ago. I think it's real interesting that. As I've mentioned on earlier programs, I'm writing a book called The Problem of God's Contracting Universe about your perspective and my perspective on the nature of the science versus religion debate through the lens of esotericism and mysticism. But it's also, I'm trying to recount your career and sort of the development of the Heart Doctrine and the Zero Point teaching. And it's real fascinating in many respects truly fascinating to see how certain ideas began, your interest in certain ideas. I remember very distinctly that you became interested after we had been studying the fourth way for about 4 or 5 years. You began to get really interested in, the idea of the astral world and questions related to the soul. And in a way that kind of led you, in part that led you to, the teachings of Swami Prabhupada, and you knew some people who the Hare Krishna guys in Toronto who were at York University where you were teaching, and you started to take from some of those ideas, and that at the same time you were interested. You and I were both really interested in the holographic paradigm and the idea of holography as a model of the structure of both the psyche and the universe, and all of these elements kind of came together in a way and led to eventually to teachings about the nature of the spiritual spark, the monad, the divine essence, whatever you want to call it, the jiva atma, being related in the heart rather than the head. But even that was sort of a fulfillment. I remember very originally when you first began writing, and when you were writing your doctoral dissertation, you were taking from the fourth way, one of the things I think that you very early on seized on was the idea that within Gurdjieff's teaching, he talks about consciousness as being something which is completely separate and distinct from the psychic function, so that we can think and feel and act with varying degrees of consciousness, but consciousness is not the contents of the mind. It's not thinking, it's not feeling, it's not acting. It's something separate. And the metaphor that appeared consistently in Gurdjieff's teaching is that it's like light, and that in our normal waking state of consciousness, which he says is a waking sleep, we typically act in that with very little illumination. So we're thinking and feeling and acting at a very low level of consciousness, essentially in the dark. But if you try to become more conscious and you work to become more conscious, you throw, as it were, a ray of light onto things, and things operate differently in the light versus the way that they operate in the dark. And so, like, from the very beginning, one of the ideas that you took from that was that what you recognized in academic Western psychology and much of Western philosophy is how consciousness is typically equated with the contents of awareness. The metaphor that comes from William James is that he talked about the stream of consciousness. So throughout a person's day, there's a parade or an unending flow of thoughts and feelings and images that enter consciousness. But what you pointed out is that consciousness is not these contents. And specifically in Western psychology, with the emphasis on consciousness coming from cognitive psychology, there is a great emphasis on the most important aspect of consciousness is thinking, or has to deal with verbalizing. And as you pointed out, consciousness is not these things. Consciousness is quite separate according to the mystical and esoteric traditions. So from that very basic idea, that was sort of, in a way, the beginning of your articulation of the head doctrine. I mean, many years later, the other thing in Gurdjieff's teaching, as you said, he says, like, we're seven brain beings, and this is a principal error that we make, is that we think we have one mind. And in Gurdjieff's teaching, he speaks in different times in reference to different ideas, but he speaks of us as being three or seven brain beings, like a complete human being in his scheme is a seven-brain being, but typically people act mentally, emotionally, and physically / practically, and even though that consists in his teaching of the moving center, moving intelligence, which is learned movement, the instinctual center, which refers to instinctual processes, and to the sexual center, and he says typically in people they operate so closely together that we can regard them as one center. So people in a normal waking state of consciousness, they're typically three brain beings according to Gurdjieff, but that they have the capacity to develop into seven brain beings and to attain the level of consciousness in which they can exist in these higher centers of intelligence, and that they can apprehend themselves in the world through these higher centers. So part of what is the germ of all that was this idea that we're multidimensional beings, that somehow consciousness is something separate from the actual psychological functionings, that consciousness is not something produced in the cortex or in any aspect of the brain, that is something else. And I mean, that was the sort of the basic building blocks, right, for what all the things that came later.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fascinating, to look back and the different realizations and insights we had, beginning with the Gurdjieff Fourth Way teaching. And as you say, like, the distinction between consciousness and what he calls the psychological functions, of which he says there are three main classes, thinking, feeling, and sensation and action as a physical body. So we're three-brained beings, but the consciousness, he says, is something separate. So the consciousness allows us to be aware of our own thoughts, or aware of our own feelings, or aware of our own sensations. But the consciousness is something separate than the psychic functions. And that was profoundly important. And as you say, that is completely contradicted what everybody in cognitive psychology was saying, who were equating thinking and imaging and all that with consciousness. Whereas Gurdjieff was saying, no, that's rubbish. So consciousness is something different, and it's like light, or it's also the background against which things are revealed, in a way. So consciousness is what enables us to be aware of different contents But thinking and feeling and sensations, they don't give you consciousness. Consciousness is something different. And so then Gurdjieff has a like profound teaching of how humankind, how ordinarily we live in a semi-sleep state. We've been so conditioned and we form a false self system, which he says centers in the mind, in the head, in what he calls the formatory apparatus. And this is all how we've been conditioned and what we've told, been led to believe. So we kind of have all this kind of false knowledge which is conditioned into the mind early on. So that becomes a false consciousness system. And then he says that a person's essential consciousness passes into their essence, or it remains in their essence. So their essential consciousness is connected more to what he calls the higher emotional center. So Gurdjieff saw that the awakening of this higher center, higher emotional center, was the means by which a human being attained that state of self-consciousness. And he said ordinarily people thought they already knew self-consciousness. But Gurdjieff was saying, but no, the self they think they know is really this false self. It's all based on this formatory conditioning, and it's centered in the mind, and it's based on the complex of all these negative emotions and imaginations and wrong ideas about things. So there's this whole false system. So he's saying we have to recover our essential consciousness, and that's how Gurdjieff talks about the stages of awakening, dying, and being reborn. That first you got to kind of like wake up and become more conscious and become conscious of yourself, and then there's a dying, because it kind of breaks down all the habit structures and what you thought you were. And then as you break down all that conditioning, then there, that enables like a rebirth, being reborn again in essence, which is in a way to attain your child's consciousness in a sense, connected to the heart. That our original consciousness is like heart consciousness, but then through our life, we kind of lose that essential consciousness and awareness of the bliss sheath in the heart. Now, Gurdjieff wouldn't talk about the bliss sheath in the heart. He only relates the state of self-consciousness, which is what he says we want to attain, this state. And he says people have the misunderstanding of what that is and think they're already self-conscious. Then it was coming to Prabhupada, Swami Prabhupada, who's saying, in the teachings in the Bhagavad Gita are so clear. He says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all beings. So the super soul, Lord Krishna, or the also called the para atma, like the infinite self or the universal self, is described as within the heart, as well as the jiva atma, which is the individualized self. And the self is compared to a spark thrown off from the infinite consciousness. There's this spark of fire, spiritual spark. And that's the ultimate, that's the jiva atma. And it's of the same substance as the paramatma. Except the paramatma is infinite and the jiva atma is infinitesimal. It's like a spiritual spark, so small that it's smaller than the material quanta. It's not a material quanta in our view of modern physics. It is smaller. More subtle again than the material world. So the study of the Gurdjieff teaching and then starting to study consciousness in ourselves and becoming more conscious. And then it came to Prabhupada, who directly teaching that consciousness is connected to the heart, which allowed me to see Gurdjieff's teaching in a different way. Because what Gurdjieff calls higher emotional center, well, that makes sense. It's awakening like in the spiritual heart. It's the higher center of emotions, which is in the spiritual heart. So in a way, it concurred with what Gurdjieff was saying, although Gurdjieff didn't elaborate it in that way. But it was a new insight of how, yeah, this is a higher emotional center, is awakening to the spiritual heart, and that's what we want to attain. And that's what Gurdjieff would call attaining real I. Yeah, that in a way that is the domain of real I. And then that led to kind of studying other yogic teachings, which have fascinating teachings all about, like, the bliss sheath in the heart, which is described as a small, about the size of a grape, and it's a mass of unemergent light. Well, the idea of there being something the size of a small grape, which is of unemergent light, that makes a lot of sense in terms of modern physics. That concept has a physical counterpart. We can conceive of what that is, a volume of this kind of light, which is unemergent. So it's like, in a way, higher dimensional light. Okay, so the idea then from Swami Prabhupada, he says, like, the self within the heart is the sun of the body. It is the light giver, and this light of the self is consciousness. So this all led, as you say, Jim, it also tied into what we were studying in holography, the idea of how in holography you have a point of laser light, which is what you use to create a holographic image. Well, here's Swami Prabhupada, who's essentially saying there's a mass of unemergent light within the heart, and that could serve as the reference beam for the creation of holographic human experience out of the physics of the heart. So here is this, like, this is a profound idea, because in modern psychology and physics, no one conceives that a human being might have such a higher dimensional light element within them that is the basis of human holographic experience. So many things came together over time, I guess, Jim, in these long studies.
Yeah. There's several different aspects to it. Again, like, going back to the original fourth way teaching, is the idea that, I know originally when I was studying it, I was getting the beginnings of it through your attempts to describe Gurdjieff's teaching in your own doctoral dissertation, and so you were working on it, and I would see you every month or so, and you'd have more material, and so it came to me kind of gradually, but made perfect sense to me in terms of psychology. But then when I started reading books about Gurdjieff and about the fourth way, and he had material on his cosmological aspects of his teaching, and his positing of the existence of the two fundamental cosmic laws, the law of three and the law of seven, and his contention that we live in this multidimensional universe where there are different gradations of materiality and consciousness that descend through the what he calls the ray of creation from the absolute, and that each of these different seven levels is under different laws, different orders of numbers of orders of laws, and that that these correspond in some way to the levels of consciousness that human beings can attain. At first I didn't really know what to make of these things, but I was willing to suspend my judgment because the other aspects of his teaching seemed to me to be so incredibly brilliant, and I realized that one of the things that Uspensky says is one of the most important things, and this goes to what you were talking about conditioning earlier, one of the most important things to know is what you do know and what you do not know. I remember you used to say that all the time and kind of used to write that down on certain things, and it's a very good reminder, because much of what we take to be our knowledge is just this formatory, automatic conditioning, and somebody gave it to us in a lecture, and we repeat it, and we think because we can repeat it that we understand things. I mean, I remember one time very distinctly, I was visiting you, and we were talking with some other graduate students at the University of Waterloo, and somebody was talking about dreams, and this one guy said, well, they're just, you know, they're just random cell assemblies, you know, that in the brain. And he just, the way he said it, you know, he was citing Donald Hebb's ideas. I think it was Hebb that
on the engrams, yeah, memory engrams,
and he was just saying that dreams are just the the random production of these. And I'm thinking, well, you don't know that. Like, I mean, you know, he was so sure of himself, though. And I'm thinking, it might be more to it, you know. I mean, it might actually be true. But, I mean, I just remember being really struck by that. And you, and this idea of formatory thinking and really is a very powerful idea, because you hear people say things all the time that you know that they don't know or understand these things. They've just been taught this, like a little clever parrot, you know, and they went and they got their little degree somewhere, and or they heard it on CNN or they read it in the New York Times or something, and they repeat it as if it's some sort of truth. But, you know, there are so many things, much of, I think, of when people say, I know God exists or I know God doesn't exist, they're just repeating what they've been conditioned or taught. Like the question, they haven't really examined the question, and that's a powerful idea, is that we have to kind of realize the importance of, I mean, a lot of what following an esoteric teaching involves is not only learning a new way to think about things and to experience things, but also how to overcome your own conditioning and how to kind of empty yourself and undo a lot of what you've been taught.
Yeah, that's like the dying part.
Yeah.
Because, like, you've accumulated all this false knowledge, what you kind of were led to believe or taught to believe. Like, you ask a person on the street, well, where did man come from?
Yeah,
and the person would say, well, man evolved through, you know, random genetic changes through Darwinian evolution, because they were told that, because they read it, because they were conditioned to believe that. And so we have all this false knowledge. And I remember another phase of the Gurdjieff teaching was the beginning to read his classic book, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And that book, as an introduction, has the most amazing statement by Gurdjieff, that the aim of his series on all and everything was to destroy mercilessly all the rubbish accumulated through the centuries in human mentation.
Yeah.
So it was like you kind of got to destroy all this false knowledge about everything, kind of all and everything that people, you've got to destroy that mercilessly, that rubbish. And so much of what we are exposed to is really has been and is rubbish, kind of.
Yeah.
You know? Well,
when Gurdjieff and Uspensky were first talking about consciousness, and Uspensky, who was a very learned man in terms of philosophy and spirituality and mathematics, a variety of things, said to Gurdjieff, well, it's generally agreed that consciousness is undefinable. And Gurdjieff dismissed it and said, the usual scientific sophistry, all rubbish, you know, and went on to explain that consciousness can be studied within oneself, and that you can know consciousness when you have it, but you can't know it when you don't have it, and that you can, if you carefully observe yourself, you will discover that you can see the appearance and disappearance of consciousness within yourself, and that when it disappears, you don't know it at the time that it's disappeared, but later you can understand that it has disappeared, and you can actually see the moment, you can recall the moment when it did disappear. And Uspensky talks about that, about how he started to study himself in terms of what Gurdjieff was talking about trying to be more conscious. And he would go through his days, and he would remember himself. And other times he describes in Search of the Miraculous going through several hours where he was walking along the street and he was trying to remember himself, and then he woke up several hours later and he realized that he'd been to his tobacconist and got his cigarettes, and he'd gone home and he'd written a couple of letters and he'd mailed them, and he'd done all these things, and then he had this vague uneasiness because he'd forgotten to do something, and he realized he'd forgotten to remember himself, and he had done all of these things quite automatically, including the writing of these letters, and unconsciously, and so that's you know, the idea that consciousness is not definable is what he was taught. But then when he began to study himself, he realized that this is quite wrong.
It was rubbish all the way along. In a way, it was like an acquired opinion, like where he had read someone who kind of said that, or that was the accepted opinion of the day.
Yeah, exactly. One thing, too, when you say about, it's interesting about about Beelzebub. I was going to say earlier when you were talking about how you came to, and that's a very interesting thing, you came to a different understanding of the fourth way after you began to study these other esoteric teachings and started having the idea of this idea of the teaching of this, this God spark within us and this source of coherent light within us in the higher dimensions, which is the source of consciousness within a human being. In a way, it's interesting because when we first got into the fourth way, we got, you used to refer to it in your original work as the Gurdjieff Uspensky teaching, and you were basing a lot of it on, of your original, exposition on the fourth way and In Search of the Miraculous by Uspensky and the Psychology of Man's Possible Evolution by Uspensky. And the, In Search of the Miraculous is Uspensky's recounting of Gurdjieff's talks and lectures that he gave in pre-revolutionary Russia to a group of pupils that he had formed, in which Uspensky was a part of that group. And it's a really remarkable book, and in some ways it's, I think it's like the best book I've ever read. And every time I read it, I learn it on an entirely different level. And I think after Gurdjieff and Uspensky had split up and Gurdjieff was teaching in the 20s in, outside of Paris, he had a car accident and he couldn't continue his work, and he resolved to write a book, which he said he was the last thing in the world he wanted to do. But he wrote this book, and he wrote a series of books, but the most important of which is Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And I think in very rough terms, if you look at the way Gurdjieff presented his ideas, and he was always changing his presentation of his ideas, always changing the presentation of his teaching. At times, he worked very directly with people, teaching them movements and breathing exercises and working with them in terms of diet and doing very, very intense body work with them. But if you look at the what appears in *In Search of the Miraculous*, you get a very you get it through Uspensky's filter. Gurdjieff said it was a very accurate representation of what he had said, but it's very intellectual. It's accessible in the sense that it's a straightforward exposition of Gurdjieff's teaching about all and everything. But then when you read his book, it's not straightforward. It's an allegory. Everything is encoded. Everything is encrypted, and nothing is said in any kind of straightforward manner. But it's all said on various levels. So the whole thing is a teaching story. So it could be understood on a whole variety of different levels. What's interesting about it, though, is that Gurdjieff isn't appealing to your mind. He's appealing to your heart. He's appealing to your emotional center more. He's trying to. When he was having it translated, he wrote it in Armenian and Russian, and he was having it translated. He kept asking the translators, what does it make you feel? What does it make you think? What does it make you feel? And he says that at one point he talks about, throughout the history of esotericism, that the primary goal is to teach the idea of objective knowledge and that the unity of everything on some level exists, and how to convey this idea. And he says that there have been different philosophical schools and religious teachings and various attempts by various groups to form principles or verbal formulas or to create symbols that embody these ideas. And he said myths are one way that myths and symbols are two of the ways that esoteric teachings have tried to embody the essence of their teachings. And in a way, I think that he describes it in terms of religious teachings, that they sometimes, in the religious teachings, there's been an attempt to create a wave of emotion which will raise people's consciousness so that they'll perceive things directly. And I think in a way, that's what Beelzebub's tales, that's the intention of it, is to create this discomfort within you, also this distance from, it's a very, I mean, it's told from the perspective
distance from
of,
yourself a bit, and from modern society, culture.
And from what it means to be human, like, I mean, it's told from the perspective of an extraterrestrial, and it's upsetting, and it's funny, and it's, in a way, it's so peculiar to hear human beings described and human history described in such on terms that it creates this real distance from it, and you start saying, well, what are these people? You know, these peculiar three-brain beings of the planet Earth. And then you
realize, the strange psyche of the three-brain beings on planet Earth. Yeah, so it gives you that kind of impartial perspective on how disturbed and unusual we are, and
he goes through so many
aspects of culture and society and everything.
And it's extremely funny, but I mean, it's also it's disconcerting in a sense, but it you disidentify with what it means to be human, and that I think is very, very profound, like how he does that, and it really makes you, and then you start thinking, well, a lot of the things that kind of appear nonsensical on the surface in the book, or you kind of like, well, what is this? You realize there's a purpose behind everything in it, and then the game is on, because you have to try to figure out, you have to work at trying to discern what he's saying. He could have said it in a straightforward way. It's very clear, like Uspensky had said that he wasn't very impressed by the original drafts of Beelzebub's Tales, and he said that Gurdjieff was the finest lecturer he had ever heard, and which is really something when you consider the circles that Uspensky moved in, and that he was obviously a very good lecturer himself, but he felt that he could express Gurdjieff's ideas in writing better than Gurdjieff could. But then when you read Meetings with Remarkable Men, which is an allegory too, but which is a very accessible and a very straightforward book, you realize Gurdjieff very easily could have written an easy-to-understand book. It's not a lack of talent.
Yeah, he didn't he wrote something so contrary to every. He kind of violates every standard of what he calls the bon ton literary language.
It's light years ahead of in the 20th century various types of experimental writing. I mean, he was doing it. You know, he was doing it in the 20s, he's deconstructing the human race in a way. That's what he's doing. One thing I was going to say too. The one other thing I was going to say that to get to this point about the heart doctrine is, in a way, I think the aim of In Search of the Miraculous, what you see the emphasis in there is that Gurdjieff is teaching about what is the nature of consciousness. But I think in Beelzebub's Tales, he's teaching what is the nature of conscience, and conscience is associated with the higher emotional center. And I think that's, in a way, I think that there are elements of the heart doctrine in Beelzebub's Tales, but they're not as explicitly stated as they are in other teachings.
Bring us back a little bit. So then there's that whole other aspect of the study of the Gurdjieff teaching and Beelzebub's Tales. And like you say, Gurdjieff says that myths are the language of the higher emotional center, and symbols are the language of the higher intellectual center. And a lot of occultism is based on mythologies, myths, and symbols. And so, so it's written on a mythological level more, as you say, that appeals to our higher emotional center, and also it has as its theme, as you say, the importance of the awakening of conscience in human beings. And he sees this as like the first step to the awakening of the higher emotional center, because if people became more conscious in their life, kind of woke up to seeing their egoism and pettiness and all their negative emotions and how much time they waste and their self-centeredness. And it's like Nicole says, if a man could wake up and see his inner world, he'd be horrified. He'd say, you know, have I gone insane?
Yeah.
And then Nicole says, in the light of the spiritual heaven, like in the spiritual light, it's like you wake up and you kind of realize, holy smokes, I've been insane in a way. And that leads to bringing about remorse of conscience. And that's the kind of breaking down of the false ego. And that's an important process to the awakening of the higher emotional center, and then attaining real I. So, So yeah, it's, and then to go back, so we began with the fourth way and all these very valuable insights into studying consciousness and what it wasn't, and consciousness as light, and then coming to the heart doctrine. And then through that, you mentioned in passing the kind of studies of what Gurdjieff says are the fundamental cosmic laws, the laws of 3 and 7. And I remembered reading that 40 years ago in the Fourth Way by Uspensky, and it struck me like, well, how peculiar. How can you kind of have like a fundamental cosmic law in the number? Like, what could that mean? Like, it was bizarre. It's hard to assess it because you don't normally, you know, we have the law of gravity and we have electromagnetism, but we don't have a law in the number. But then through the years of understanding esotericism more and more deeply, I understand that, as Blavatsky says, like, God geometizes in all universal manifestations. There's a kind of an inner geometry and form generation according to certain numerical principles. So that very, like, you can take something like a triangle. Like, I look now at what, when I see a triangle, like what that kind of represents to me. And that, in a way, like, that's a law of three, obviously, in the triangle. But, like, in a way, that's so profound what that means and how all things in creation have a triune nature. All things are same. And there's nothing I can find that is simply dualistic. Everything has a triune nature. Anytime you find a duality, you can also find third force, which kind of brings the opposing forces into relationship. So there's always third force, and Gurdjieff says mankind is third force blind. So we have to learn to think in threes instead of thinking dualistically, like the Hegelian, synthesis. Well, actually, Hegelian believed in moving triads. That's what Hegel actually believed. He believed in the synthesis, antithesis, and then a thesis, antithesis.
Antithesis, yeah.
Yeah, and then
synthesis is what moves it forward, yeah.
Yeah, and he saw this as moving triads. So even Hegelian's ideas been taken dualistically, whereas he really believed in moving triads, which is what Gurdjieff is saying. And the profound significance of this concept in trying to understand, like, science, like modern science, they function mainly two dualities, matter and energy within time and space. And those four elements are the kind of the four elements of modern physics. All equations are kind of combinations of matter and energy manifesting within time and space. So science is kind of dualistic. So if I took their matter and energy, the way I see it now is the third force is intelligence. Intelligence. And that's what all mystics are saying. It's in the Eastern teachings of the Vedas that there are three modes of nature. Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. And they stand for light and intelligence is the first. Sattva is light and intelligence. And then Rajas is the energy principle or desire or emotion. And then Tamas is the material or mass principle. So everything has an energetic, intellectual, and mass aspect to it. So everything has a threefoldness, even like a human being. It makes so much sense. Like we thinking, emotions, and desires, and then the physical body. So we're three-brain being because we embody the three modes of nature. We have an intellectual, emotional, and physical aspect to us. We have those three bodies in a way. So it was this study of the profound nature of trying to understand these basic concepts of the law of three and then the law of seven, which gives you a unique perspective on the issues of modern science and cosmology and the discussion of science and religion and such. Because you realize in mystical teachings, mystics are actually proposing this as a metaphysical model of creation. Like that's implicit in mystical teachings, is a metaphysical model of creation based on certain numeric principles, which are illustrated by what Gurdjieff would say are symbols of the higher intellectual center. Like I would say the tree of life of Kabbalistic teachings is a symbol of the higher intellectual center. It is a profound mathematical, geometrical symbol which embodies higher knowledge. The problem is for people to understand that knowledge embodied in the symbol. And it's hard for people to understand, like, how someone like myself, I've studied the tree of life through 30 to 40 years now, and it always kind of, you come to a deeper appreciation of it, its profound significance and application. It's just kind of, yeah, it's an amazing process of growth you come to, like, to try to understand. Gurdjieff said, psychology, you have to study the fundamental cosmic laws in yourself and in the universe or the cosmos, the laws of 3 and 7. So they're principles by which we try to study things, to discern things. And they're profound heuristics or tools of thought. And you begin to realize how much ordinarily everybody thinks dualistically. And it's so simplistic. That's what I realized as a psychologist. And psychology was defined as the science of behavior and the mind, as though a person only has a mind in the head and it's stuck on the material body. And that's modern psychology, the science of behavior and the mind. And it's so simplistic. There's no science of the heart and soul. You see, that's the third force, the science of the heart and soul. So anyway, and in physics, they think there's matter and energy. But in the new physics, now in all the quantum and holographic models, they do now think that information is the third force that is inherent within space itself as part of the quantum vacuum and the zero-point fields. So now the idea in science is, no, there are information fields which permeate space. And the information fields are what guide and direct the manifestations of matter and energy within time and space. That there's an intelligence there, which is, of course, a mystical view, that space itself is like there's an intelligence inherent within space itself, which is like pervaded by these spiritual intelligences. Space is not just empty and void, but there's a correlation of everything that happens. It's all connected through the ethers of space. But anyway, so Jim, the study of the ideas of the laws of 3 and 7, I mean, that's been, I still, every week, I mean, these last couple of weeks, I've had just all these new insights. I just, once again, understand, I want to explain one of the things I came to, applying this kind of thinking, a new thing I came to. I want to share that today.
Yeah.
But that was another, so the study of the cosmological laws in Gurdjieff and his concept of the ray of creation, that was so profound. It's like a model of how a human being is a microcosm of the macrocosm. And so in his ray of creation, there's a level of the sun, there's a level of the planets, there's a level of the earth, and there's a level of the moon. Those are three of the levels. And above that's a starry world, like the galaxy. Those are some of the levels. And it's how what Gurdjieff was saying, he was saying we exist within worlds interconnected to all those levels of the cosmos simultaneously. That there's something in the human being that originates and has affinity with the sun. And later it came to mystical teachings teaching the way our higher self is within the sun. Or it is the sun within ourself, which is connected to the sun. We are said to be sons of the sun. So there's a level of the sun within us. And the idea, Gurdjieff says, we want to attain to the level of the sun, and that is to attain your spiritual body connected to this level of the sun. And he says our essences are related to the sun and also to the planetary sphere, which kind of affects what we are in our essence, in our personal individualized essence. And then he says there's a part of us that's connected to the earth. So the physical body, it dies, it goes back into the earth. It was formed of the physical earth. And then Gurdjieff says there's a part of ourself, certain energy connected to the soul, which passes to the moon at death. and that souls can be drawn to the moon. Souls can be devoured by the moon, in a way. If we become a lunatic, under 96 laws in the level of the cosmos, which is a very remote, to be under 96 laws under the moon, and the level of the earth is 48 laws, and the level of the planets 24, and the sun 12. Like, it's like these different worlds, and each of them are under different numbers of laws. And all, it's a very profound kind of holographic model of a human being. That's what I realized, eh, Jim? It's like how you have all this multidimensional space which interpenetrates it. Each level is interpenetrated by the other within the same space. It's not like they're above each other.
Yeah, what I was just going to say is that that's what's so critical, is that he says that all these worlds interpenetrate one another, and that there's no need to go to the sun to find solar matter. It's in everything that's in the stones with which we build our houses. It's in us, you know. And I mean, this is many years before the discovery of neutrinos too, which, I mean, you know, and these incredibly small particles that are passing through the earth. But he was saying that everything in creation vibrates, and it vibrates at a different level. So in a way, he's sort of describing something like string theory, you know, like 100 years ago, eh? That everything consists of these vibrations, and everything's material. Even thought is material, but it's a very subtle level of materiality, and that all things are either evolving or they're involving. So they're either rising to a greater level of unification and coherence, or they're degrading into more disorder and mechanicalness. And this is one thing that really struck me as about his teaching, is that, you know, that he's talking about the isomorphism between human beings and between the cosmos, and that there are these different levels within us which exist within the cosmos. But he says that in order to study ourselves and in order to study consciousness, we have to study ourselves, but we also have to study the cosmos. And certain things are more readily observable and understandable if we study them on a cosmological level, and other things are more observable and accessible if we study them within ourselves, but that these principles apply on both the cosmological and the psychological level. So this changes the whole nature of the study of psychology. Psychology is not something contained within the cerebral cortex, and it's not something contained within the skin-encapsulated ego, that we are somehow in the cosmos, and the cosmos is somehow within us. And as you see, this is a profound holographic model of what it means to be human. And well, there's so many different aspects that flow from that. But as I say, I think this, to me, like when I began to really understand that, like when I got over my own trepidation and apprehension about some of his cosmological ideas, like, for instance, very basic thing was that I really began to understand the law of three when you applied it to a critique of existing ideas within psychology and modern science, that showed how these formatory dualities are consistently put out there. And it just so happened that at the time, it was at the height of the whole craze about the hemispheric lateralization, about the two brains that are within us, and everybody was going nuts trying to assign every conceivable human attribute and aptitude and feature to either the left brain or the right brain. Now, there's something to that, but this was grossly overstated and illogically so, as you very cleverly pointed out, because people equate they invent opposites for things, but often the same things are the opposites for several different things.
I invent
word game that people just, like, I mean, they're just making things up and assuming that, okay, I'll think of an attribute, a human attribute, let's say abstraction, and then I'll think of its opposite, and that will complete, you know, that will form a whole. But that's like such a ridiculous exercise, because it's premised on a dubious proposition to start with, and is really, like, it doesn't describe anything. It's just sort of a word game that people were playing with themselves. But as I say,
well,
I began to understand that, like, that's really something to that, like, that the idea of the law of three.
I think when one way of seeing it is when people think dualistically, they got two-thirds of the solution. You know, like they got part of it, like because nature has dual aspects to it, male, female, you know, life, death. Like there are all sorts of duality, so there is a validity to it, but it's when you conceive of them and you find third force, and then it reveals how everything has a triune nature, and that leads to a whole new way of understanding.
Well, and that, again, like what Gurdjieff says, that people are third force blind, you know, and that often the third force is either hidden or it's the medium itself that exists, in which the duality exists. Yeah, dualities exist.
Yes.
They're all over the place. But the problem is that people tend to think dualistically, which in a very automatic way, and don't go beyond that, and that's it. Psychologically, I understood the law of three, but then as I started to study it in other esoteric teachings, I started to see, like, when in terms of the gunas, for instance, like, oh, okay, here's, like, this is parallels the idea when Gurdjieff is that everything consists of these triads, which are propagating through all levels of nature, and you know, there's an active and a passive and a neutralizing force, and that they're in dynamics. The dynamics of each of these things occurs within a certain sphere and within a certain medium, and then these forces change and they become something else. But there's always these three forces interacting, and it's very powerful. As you say, it's a heuristic. It's a way of understanding things, but it also exposes.
Yeah.
It very much exposes the formatory nature of thinking. That's what struck me so much about it all, is that it's such a good way to understand things that people are not, they haven't really thought of these things. They've just followed sort of one of the characteristics that Gurdjieff says of formatory thinking, which is that it's dualistic and it follows the path of least resistance. It's not really thinking. It's kind of pseudo thinking. It's thinking posing as cognition, but it's not real thinking, and it's not conscious thinking. I guess that's the bottom line. But anyway, that whole thing, that tying psychology and cosmology together and seeing them as being intricately related, leads to a completely different paradigm for the study of consciousness, for the study of psychology, because we're not contained within the physical body. We don't just consist of the material processes in our body. There's something much more profound beyond that, and we have the capacity to realize these higher levels within ourselves and within the universe.
Yeah, there's something in us that, in a sense, emerges from within without.
Yeah.
Like, within without from the heart of being. That's how it is described in the secret doctrine of Madame Blavatsky. She says all the suns and expand and contract through their own selves and hearts. That's from a stanza of Zen from the secret doctrine. So, just to go back, you were saying about, like, how Gurdjieff said that third force is often inherent within the medium of space, and so hence it's invisible to us. And then that fits in so perfectly with this whole concept of information fields within space, within the quantum vacuum, how everything there, underlying everything material, are these kind of information fields.
And it's like,
but that's invisible to us, because that's hidden in within space itself, and you have the mystical significance attached to space. Like, we talk about the space in which we live and move and breathe and have our being. That space for Blavatsky is this kind of living embodiment. It's like God's sensorium. That space is the means by which God knows itself, and its potencies, they're revealed through space. And space is permeated by that omniscience.
Isn't that Newton that called space God's sensorium?
Yeah.
Wasn't that Newton? Yeah.
It's in that wartime quote from that excellent book, Pythagoras' Trousers. She quotes him.
That's an interesting phenomenon in and of itself too, is how in physics, in classical physics, you, like you said, you have these dualities. You have time and space, and you have matter and energy, and then you have the relativity revolution, and then quantum mechanics in the 20th century. And you realize that, well, there are limitations. Like Newtonian classical mechanics works very well for explaining and describing things at various levels, but as you approach the speed of light and when you get very, very small in terms of matter, these things break down, they no longer apply. And then you have the whole extraordinary development of quantum mechanics in the early part of the 20th century, but eventually the pursuit of the fundamental building blocks and the trying to penetrate to the heart of matter, you end up finding that we've been looking at things dualistically when really we have to look at things in terms of this trinity. And the third part, as you say, is its intelligence, because the irony is that really the pursuit of matter led to the end of materialism. It's like Karl Popper said that, you know, in quantum mechanics, matter transcends itself because it's impossible to explain things simply in terms of matter and energy. You need this third force, which is alternatively intelligence, information, or consciousness, depending on how who's speaking and how they're speaking about it. But
Now in modern physics, see, you have total support for what Blavatsky was saying, because in the new model of the nature of the quantum vacuum, all material particles are surrounded by fields of virtual particles, and everything that manifests physically is subtended or supported, or it's only an outward manifestation of all these fields that support it within the quantum vacuum, all these zero point fields and polarizations of the quantum vacuum and different levels to it and so on. So what appears, what manifests is in modern science now, they believe that it's all an outward product of space itself.
So
this idea is actually now emerged in science as part of the new science. It's no longer third force blind.
It's interesting. I mean, do you think that if people had been aware of these ideas, or if they had studied these ideas and taken them seriously, if there would have been more of a breakthrough if people had studied the secret doctrine or taken mystical. I mean, I know that many of the later in their lives, many of the great physicists of the 20th century did come to become very interested in classic esoteric and mystical sources from the East. But I mean, it would be very interesting if somebody had actually been influenced by these things. I don't know of any cases.
What they might have anticipated or predicted.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it would be, I'm keeping that in mind as I rewrite my book on the secret doctrine. Like, what kinds of things could I predict or put forward as hypotheses to either confirm or invalidate basic ideas in the secret doctrine? Like, it's a very interesting question. I've never really fully thought it out, because it's hard to be, you know, most time is trying to explain the concept, but then to think it out. But it's funny, I've come up with a lot of things lately. Like, there's certain things, like I want to give this example of the study of occult thinking. Okay. I mentioned earlier that there was something I wanted to share. So I'd like to try to come back to this and try to explain this a little bit. And this is just such a profound, it takes us back to what we've been talking about over the last while, two things. One is the image of a Star of David with a central point. And if people are there, if you have a piece of paper in that, draw a Star of David, which is two interlaced triangles, with a central point. Okay, now, in a way, the central point stands, embodies the one, or in a way, the sun, S-O-N, like the sun born out of the absolute. And if you put a triangle faced upwards, that represents a spiritual world, and you put a downward turn triangle, that represents the material world. So the Star of David with the central point, it indicates, in a way, I would say it's the I stuck between these two worlds or embodied between spirit and matter. And you see that like in the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God creates the heaven and the earth. So the idea in spiritual teachings is there's a spiritual world on a higher plane of existence. And then there's a material plane, which reflects the quality of the spiritual planes, but into a lower level of materiality. So man, a human being, in a way is like that point in the Star of David. You're stuck between these two worlds, the spiritual world and the material world. But anyway, this Star of David, in a way, I would say if you had to pick a symbol to embody the teachings of the secret doctrine about creation physics, this is the best symbol to use, is the Star of David with the central point. Or in Theosophy, Blavatsky in the center puts an Ankh. An Ankh is an Egyptian symbol, and it represents the living entity. An Ankh is like a cross, but with the top part is a circle. And that Ankh represents the individual I, and it is at the center of the Star of David. So this is a profound symbol. And this symbol, like the sequence, I would say, of divine geometry, to give a simple formula, it's, Nicole says, God is first one, then three, and then seven. And it's like white light divided by a three-sided prism, and it gives you a spectrum of seven colors. So the idea, see, in mystical teachings, creation is manifest out of the divine lux, meaning divine light. So the idea that it would follow the laws of three and seven in a way makes sense, because that's, if you take white light and divide it by a prism, it gives you those spectrum of seven colors. So it's like a pattern in creation. But mystics are saying this same pattern of the three and sevenfoldness, that pattern exists in all phenomena, embody that same pattern of the three and the seven. Like you can look at the material world, and it's composed of protons, electrons, and neutrons, three basic elements, and then you have seven rows of elements in the periodic table. So the pattern of the one, the three, and the seven, in a way, that holds true for matter, and it holds true for energy, and you can apply it to time, and you can apply it to space, to all these different areas. You can apply that 1-3-7 thinking. Okay, now, in the secret doctrine, if you had to, the magical formula I would say that the secret doctrine is based on, first you would have just a one, and that is the absolute. That is the unspeakable, the deity, that. Okay, it is just the one. Okay, now, in mystical views of the secret doctrine, when the absolute, when creation happens, the first one born is also seen as a one. Like it's like the sun is born out of the absolute. Like the individual cosmos is born out of the absolute. So that becomes a new one. And then that has a triune and sevenfold nature. Now, if you put the first one of the absolute on the top as the nominator of the equation, and you put 1-3-7 as the denominator of the equation, you have the fraction 1 divided by 1-3-7. In a way, that is the fundamental mystical formula of the secret doctrine. Like that's embodied in the teachings of the secret doctrine. And then as we've been talking about, like the last week we talked about this, it turns out that the number 1 divided by 137 is this number. It's called the alpha constant in physics, and it's this special ratio of the velocity of light compared with the electrical charge on an electron and Planck's constant, which are three fundamental constants of nature related. The light is related to light, intelligence, mind. The charge on an electron is the energy principle, the electrical charge, basic unit of electrical charge. And then Planck's constant is a measure of the discreteness or mass-like quantity of a particle. So in a way, these three fundamental constants of nature, the speed of light, the charge on an electron, and the Planck's constant, if you put those in relationship, they turn out to the number 137. And it's this kind of unusual constant of nature called the alpha constant that no one can explain, and has this remarkable history in terms of synchronicities and such, and related to the, maybe you want to mention, Jim, the Pauli's coincidence around that.
Oh, just that, Eddington was the one who was really fascinated by it, but Pauli was also fascinated just by synchronicities and coincidences, and wrote that book with Carl Jung on synchronicities, and then and was well aware of the importance of 137, and ended up going into the hospital and checking into room 137 and realizing, it's kind of odd too, because it's the alpha, and it ended up being the omega for Pauli, eh? So it was the end. But yeah.
But I mean, how bizarre! I mean, in terms of like that, really. I would say, honestly, is the best formula from the metaphysics of the secret doctrine is number 1 divided by 137. And then that is the fundamental constant of nature. I mean, it's so profound. And not only that, but it's a constant that's not expressed in units. So it's in a ratio, like it's a unitless number.
It's very interesting, because I just began to read this book, Is God a Mathematician? Very interesting book. And he goes back and he begins with talking about the Pythagoreans and then the Platonists, and Plato and the Platonists and Neoplatonists. And the question that still exists today is mathematics something inherently in nature, and some sort of fundamental aspect of nature, or is it something that's just a human construction? And I mean, I think it's pretty clear to me. It's like it's in nature. Like, I mean, it's a very interesting question, eh? But something like that, like
the mystical viewpoint is that it's inherent in nature. Idea of God geometizes, and that there are certain sacred symbols which are the product of higher mind, higher intellectual center, which embody this higher wisdom, including the Star of David with the central point, and the Tree of Life in Kabbalah. And then it's more complex, Ladder of Jacob. Sorry, do we have a guest? Or someone come in?
I don't know.
Oh, I thought I heard something.
Well, there's a bit of a blip there. That idea that God geometrizes, I think that actually goes right back to the Pythagoreans. And he discusses in this book, too, that, you know, that supposedly at Plato's Academy, you know, that there was supposed to be a sign, although nobody really knows if this is true, but or if this was sort of invented after the fact, but, you know, let no one enter here who is not wise in the ways of geometry, or something, or who does not know geometry. You know, I mean, because these are, you know, like the Platonic idea was that these were ideals, these were mathematical examples, are substantial mathematical examples, were forms of these higher, what, Platonic ideals.
Ideals, yeah. Let me give an example of that I think really explains a bit what's meant by this. You know the Star of David with the central point? If that Star of David, I would say, was in perfect symmetry, like the triangles, that would disappear from view. You see, when creation happens, it's that the symmetries are broken.
Oh, I see. I
so yeah. Then the perfect form isn't generated in natural form because there's broken symmetries. That's what happens. And if something, again, like if you had three forces that came back in perfect equilateral relationship to each other, they would disappear.
Yeah.
They would be unmanifest. That creation is due to broken symmetries out of this higher dimensional space. So I would say something like the Star of David embodies a form in higher dimensions, but it's not, it's broken symmetries when it manifests in terms of creation physics.
Well, that gets back to what we were just talking about earlier, too, is that in nature there are all these dualities. So like in that symbol, you have these two triangles, one pointing up, one pointing down, so the base and the apex are turned over. But as you're saying, if there was if everything was in a state of quiescence and with where everything was at rest, something has to happen. A third force has to happen, which creates this duality, which breaks this symmetry. Everything's symmetrical, breaks this symmetry, and now you have a manifestation, and you have these two triangles. I mean, another way of looking at it too is you're talking about the spiritual and the material. Is that the triangle pointing downward is the involutionary current, and the triangle pointing upward is the evolutionary current. And so the dot in the middle is that's like Gurdjieff says, man stands between two worlds. You know, there's an evolving current and there's an involving current. And to enter the evolutionary current, you can't do it automatically. Like it requires effort. Like everything is actually flowing downwards. It's coming from above, and that's our task here. We can serve as a corrective to a certain level to help relieve the sorrows of his endlessness, as Gurdjieff calls him, by evolving. But that can't happen in Gurdjieff's opinions for an individual. That doesn't happen automatically. That can't happen without effort and without the exercise of will. So that's another way of looking at it, like that there's these...
Again, there's so much symbolism in that.
Yeah.
Blavatsky sees it like as the highest symbol of magic, especially with its central element. And it's also what's so profound is how the Rothschild shield is empty inside, and like the flag of Israel, those are two triangles, it adds to six, and there's six lines and six apexes, but there's nothing in the center, and it's like it's empty inside. Whereas the Star of David, like Blavatsky says, you put a dot or an ankh in the center, all of a sudden the six-sided 666 figure becomes this kind of magical symbol of higher perfection, is with the seventh central point, which he says is the seventh key, is this central point. So Blavatsky assigns a profound significance to this. And in rereading The Secret Doctrine, I've been working on my book on it, what's most amazing, she also then uses this symbol to represent the seven luminous lords, like the seven divine intelligences which sculpt the void, or the Elohim. And she uses these symbols and again depicts them as a triangle with the central point. But I want to make another point about this symbol. Is the idea how often when you have seven, that in a way the seventh has a special quality, like there's something about one of them that the seventh is either the original or the seventh and contains all the other six within itself. So I want to explain that. Like I talked earlier about if you take white light divided by a prism and it gives a spectrum of seven colors. Okay. Well, another way of looking at it would be if you took white light divided by a prism and it really gives you six colors. Like if you count it seven, you go red, orange, yellow, blue, green, blue, violet, indigo. and people differentiate violet and indigo, which kind of are different shades of purplish, kind of. Okay, but another way of thinking, when you see most people actually break the spectrum down into six colors, and they don't differentiate violet and indigo. So suppose instead of saying a spectrum of seven colors, we take the spectrum to have six colors. So then what would the seventh color be? Well, the seventh color would be the white, which contains all the other six colors in itself, but it's like the culmination of all the other colors. So instead of seeing the spectrum of having seven colors, it really has six colors, but the seventh color is when you have all those completed and it gives you white light.
Well,
isn't that a neat, sorry, Jim?
You could even say that in terms of light seven. If there's seven colors, the seven are in the one, because the white is the coherence of all the subsidiary elements. Like, white isn't a color, it's all of those colors, like, recombined.
Well, that's what I'm saying. See, it is a color. In a way, it's a color that contains all the other colors. That's what I'm saying. It's the seventh color is this kind of primary that contains the other six. That's the concept. But in the Star of David, it's you have the special kind of significance of the point in the center has a different kind of status than the other six colors. Or the other six points. But let me carry this on a little bit more forward with this. Because I started, this has been my insight or idea from this last week, because I've been rewriting my book on the secret doctrine, and I'm so pleased with it. It's so remarkable to kind of understand this more deeply again. But one of the questions I came up with, Blavatsky says all the laws of nature are seven variations of one fundamental cause. Seven variations of Fohat, he calls it. So, and she says seven variations of this fundamental cosmic electricity. So she says, like, there are seven. In a way, based on the secret doctrine, I would think there should be seven fundamental laws in modern physics, but modern physics only has four. Okay, so how do I relate what Blavatsky's saying to the fact that modern physics has only four fundamental forces? So this is what I arrived at. And I'd like you to just follow along this line of thinking, Jim. You know how they have the four forces, electromagnetism, the weak, the strong, and gravity.
Right.
Now, and they count those as four fundamental forces. Okay, even though historically, at one point, electricity and magnetism were regarded as separate phenomena.
Right.
Okay? Yeah, they were regarded. And then light was, a third phenomena. Like, even though light is described by the electromagnetic force, light is something very different than electricity related to electron currents. Okay, like they're interrelated, but light is something significantly different than electricity, which is something significantly different than magnetism. Even though the three of them are related and are variations of one force, but they're still that three separateness of it. I mean, light propagates at the speed of light, but you can't propagate an electron at the speed of light. Like, there's something different about light as a variation of electromagnetic phenomena. There's something different about light and electricity and magnetism, okay? So, why don't we, instead of just calling it the electromagnetic force, how about we break it down and represent it as a triangle? And at the apex of the triangle, you put light. And on the right side, you put energy. And on the left, you put matter. Okay, or actually, sorry, I got mixed up. On the right, you would put electricity for energy. And matter would be magnetism.
Right.
Okay, so instead of, see, what happened in my, well, I had an insight. I realized, like, in modern physics, they achieved, almost 20 years ago, a unification of what they call the electroweak force, which is they derived a model where they were able to integrate the electromagnetic force and the weak force into one force they now call the electroweak. Well, when they integrated those two into the one electroweak, why didn't they then say, oh, now we only have three fundamental laws of physics? Eh? Wouldn't it follow? You see what I mean? And
yeah,
then
yeah.
you might have electroweak, which you might unify with the strong force in what are called the gut theories, general unified theories, grand unified theories. So then you could say, well, now we only have two forces. Okay, but they didn't. In a way, they keep it at four. Well, what my concept was, suppose you take a triangle turned upwards to represent light, magnetism, and electricity, and then you represented the other three fundamental forces of nature with a downward turned triangle in a Star of David pattern. And at the bottom, you would have gravity, and on the upper right, you would have the weak force, because the weak force, in a way, it's above us, it's in the sun, because the weak force is the main means by which the sun generates light and heat and life within the solar system, is the physics of the sun. The weak force allows for the transmutation of subatomic particles. And that is involved in the sun. Okay. And then on the left side, you have the strong force. Now, here, you have the weak and the strong force both on the higher level. And in a way, they're both on the higher level because they occur at a lower level in the quantum vacuum. Like, they only manifest the strong and weak force down at, 10 to the minus however many centimeters. They only manifest as forces down at the subatomic level. That's why they weren't discovered as forces until this last century. Okay, until we developed particle physics. And then we discovered two forces down at particulate level. Okay. So anyway, if you take what they call the four laws of gravity, and you show them as a pattern of six, and then you put the seventh central one in, and the aim in physics now is to integrate all those laws of physics into one, what Paul Davies calls godlike superforce, which would be this kind of unified force out of which the others are all manifestations. And you could put that godlike superforce as a point in the center. So you could use a Star of David with the central point to depict the seven fundamental laws of nature instead of sticking with modern science's conception of there being four fundamental laws of physics. It's simply another way of viewing and interpreting the same data. Wow. Isn't that interesting, Jim?
Yeah.
And there's more to it because there's more to the subtleness of some of the information contained in those triangles, like how the weak and strong and gravity are related as forces and against the electromagnetic. And it's like in reading The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky uses the Star of David with its central point to represent the Dion Chohan, which for her are the Elohim, or the seven luminous suns, or the seven divine builders, or the builders of form from formlessness. So she uses the Star of David to represent the Dion Chohan. Okay, but in The Secret Doctrine, the idea is the same patterns of creation are reiterated over and over again on different levels and within different cosmoses. So in a way, the Star of David with the central point also represents our own nature. So this idea, it's a profound alternative kind of conceptualization of the laws of physics. And I make a good point when I argue, well, why then, when they integrate electromagnetism and weak, why don't they reduce it to three fundamental forces? You see? In a way, they could do that. You know, they reduced electricity and magnetism to one force, whereas really they're quite separate variations of one force. I'm not denying they're variations of one force. See, Blavatsky's saying that the forces are all variations of one force. That's what she's saying.
Yeah.
So it's just a way, different way of conceptualizing the fundamental laws of nature based on the Star of David, the application of the Star of David. And it's really quite profound
to
view it.
That's what I was getting at earlier when I asked that question, like about, you know, if people took these ideas seriously, if, for instance, in the Secret Doctrine or followed other esoteric teachings, how would things have been different, or how would conception? That's a very interesting example. Is like this leads to a very different conceptualization or representation of things, anyways. And
yes, it does exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now,
so
what then are the? What then? How could we test it? Or it's hard to say. It's hard to, you know, we have to think it out. We have to like consider it in this way and see where that leads us. But I think it's perfectly logical that in a way we could see these forces of nature as sevenfold variations of one force.
Wow.
I mean, physicists are trying to unify the forces of nature into one godlike superforce. That's what they call it. And that's what I would say would be represented by the point at the center of the Star of David, is that force which kind of contains the other six forces in itself. It's the godlike superforce. It's, yeah. Anyway, so that's been a new insight, and I'm going to bring, you know, my new chapter on the Secret Doctrine book. I'm going to go into the alpha constant, and I'm going to go into proposing this new model of how to interpret the four fundamental laws of nature. I think it's really important.
Yeah, I've been actually. I've been reading. I told you before. I read this book called Biology Revisioned by Elizabeth Soutouris, American biologist, and Willis Harmon, who used to be with the Noetics Institute of Noetics in California, has since passed away. But it's a conversation about Harmon was a consciousness researcher, an interesting guy. It's a conversation about biology, and Soutouris really subscribes to the idea of the importance of consciousness as being primary, and the idea of multidimensional beings in a multidimensional universe. Very, very interesting woman, very interesting thinker, and I went on the internet and just found a bunch of interviews and brief articles by her, very interesting ideas. I think she would be... She talks about the need for a, you know, holistic model, and about the need for a model which represents and recognizes the great chain of being. And she talks a little bit about Wilbur's work about, you know, how the idea of nested hierarchies, which is essentially what Gurdjieff is explaining in the Ray of Creation, where you have different levels which are subsumed by higher levels, which, you know, which contain but inform them on other levels, and she's applying that to biology and saying that, I mean, she just says the whole idea that everything happened in terms of evolutionary biology by accident is one of the most harebrained ideas in the history of science, and will be recognized as such very soon, you know. And I thought it was I was really, really impressed by this book that I read with her and some of the comments. So I actually sent her the first two chapters of The Problem of God's Contracting Universe.
Oh.
To I don't know if she'll get it, but you know, because just telling her briefly about you know, your work and about our work and sort of what the book was about, and just sort of laying it out like the broad strokes of it. So it'll be interesting. So, I mean, you know, like your work focuses on physics, but like there's this whole huge area of great discussion and controversy in biology. Like, I see how biology is so completely been swallowed up in this mechanistic model, which is, you know, much like Newtonian physics works very well on a certain level, but doesn't really explain anything comprehensively, because it can't, because at some level, the problem with biology is that it can't explain life. It can describe it, and it can, to a certain extent, it can address how things go wrong, and it can correct things. But it can provide a model for these things, but it can't really account for it. And that's just so interesting, because those are still the two fundamental questions confronting science. Is like, and really, the whole materialist perspective is an inadequate paradigm and model to deal with it. Is what is the nature of consciousness? What is the nature of life?
And the origin of humankind. I think that's a profound mystery.
That goes hand in hand with what is the nature of life and what is the nature of consciousness. Yeah, what is the origin of humankind? I was like, yeah. And all of these questions are huge questions, despite all our sophistication and all the wonderful things that we can do scientifically, like, we're so far from understanding these things. And yet, I think what we do understand is, I think we understand that these models don't work. I think that there's no doubt.
We don't have an answer.
That's why it's sort of like the resistance to exploring mystical and esoteric teachings is so stupid, because I think in those teachings there's such clues as to that phrase from William Powers, hints from inside of matter, you have to go inside of the material world to understand how, things originate from within without, and that's an interesting example too. It's like, in Powers' book, he talks about heat, and remember way back when, like, when you were doing your dissertation and you talked about, that it wasn't until heat was understood as being the result of this motion within matter that it was understood, like the construct of heat, was the concept of it was really understood. And it's like you said, it's like Powers has this phrase that they needed clues, hints from inside of matter to understand what heat was. And that's sort of what we need in terms of understanding consciousness.
Yeah.
We have to have, and ironically, you probably didn't have a clue as to how profound, really, in a way, like that applies to what you've discovered, because it is from inside of matter, but it's in these higher dimensions that you had to go to really get inside of matter. So, I mean, that's kind of ironic in a sense that...
It's interesting, another thing that's been happening to me this last week or 2 weeks is... I've felt really impelled to begin to reread volume 2 of The Secret Doctrine. And it's called Anthropogenesis. And it's amazing in terms of, like, well, it's like I would like to do a second book of my God, Science, and The Secret Doctrine. Because book 1 is on the cosmogenesis and metaphysics of The Secret Doctrine. But book 2 would address the issues of what is the nature of life, evolution, and the history of humankind. Because, again, it's like Blavatsky had this amazing view of all these earlier races and kind of failed experiments by nature and amazing kind of alternative history of humankind on this planet. And it includes, like Atlantis, like she saw that as on the fourth round preceding us, and before that was Lemuria, and, Hyperborean before that, and she has, like, teachings about all these things. I mean, they're beyond my comprehension, but I feel it, I need to try to do with anthropogenesis what I've done with cosmogenesis. And so now I'm conceiving doing this next book on that and trying to examine some of these issues. And one of the most important things that is a thesis of anthropogenesis that's very significant is that Blavatsky says the astral body is formed before the physical body. Mm-hmm. And that's really significant. Like, that's the idea in mystical teachings, that the subtler bodies are formed first. And they form the template or provide the field of information, which then organizes, like, the formation of the material body. And Blavatsky sees She has a remarkable view of like how a human being is created by these living intelligences associated with the planets. Like Blavatsky would say, like the sun, for instance, has seven luminous suns, which are seven man, like seven lords, seven angels or archangels, okay? These are seven spiritual intelligences associated with our sun. But then the moon has intelligences, so the lunar intelligences, and she calls them the lunar prithis. Okay, so there's these actual intelligences associated with the moon, and she says they form the material, the astral body. And then she says the earth prithis formed the material body. So, most people, like, most attempts to look at mystical teachings about creation, it's like so superficial. It's like God just created everything and that's it. You know, there's nothing in between. Whereas Blavatsky's saying, in creation, there's a whole hierarchy of intelligences that are, she calls them masons. In a way, they carry out God's will. They manifest God's will on different planes of reality. So it's not that God creates, you know, human beings on earth. It's not God who does it. Even in the book of Genesis itself, if you read what it says, God says, let the earth bring forth living creatures. So even in the book of Genesis, it's the earth brings forth. And then it's the waters bring forth. It doesn't say God did it. Even in the book of Genesis, it never did. It's a command, a will of a higher being that's then made manifest through other intelligence forces, masons, or builders. And there are different builders associated with different realms of nature. So it's a profound kind of alternative conceptualization of, you know, Blavatsky's view of space is that you have the influences and intelligences of these simultaneous beings that are present within us, like the lunar prithis and the earth prithis and the solar prithis, you know, and that we as a human being, we're a composite of these different levels. And in a way, like it comes back to, we want to attain to the level of the sun, the solar prithis. We don't want to be, you know, at death. You don't want to pass to the moon and feed the lunar prithis and live in the sphere of the moon in this lower dimensional realm. So that's a little bit about Blavatsky, and she has such amazing stuff because she says, for instance, that there were races of giants, and there is supposedly even fossil evidences of this which are claimed to be hidden. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but there's so many enigmas. You look at these architectural wonders that have never been explained and whether we come from aliens and so on. And it's amazing. Blavatsky has a whole alternative kind of way of trying to approach these mysteries. No, I don't know the answers, but it's interesting. You've always been inclined to want to explore these issues of biology and evolution, and I really hope that, you know, once I publish this God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, on that part of the Secret Doctrine, you know, I hope over the next years that I'll start working at a book on anthropogenesis and try to address these issues.
Very interesting. As I say, the more I read about... I didn't even take high school biology, so I was a little bit, but I've always been interested in just the philosophical issues about biology because, as I say, I understand it in terms of the history of science, and I understand that this model has been applied, and there's certainly huge gaps in the mechanistic, materialistic model and how it applies. Like I say, it's got the small problem that it really can't explain the origin of life, you know, which is kind of central.
Yeah, a little bit of a problem.
a bit of a problem, but I mean, I'm reading this book on the brain that changes itself, on neuroplasticity, and mm-hmm. And the guy's explaining very interesting literature, and I mean, it's entirely consistent with what I already believed in, but he lapses into these kind of mechanistic metaphors at times, and I think he wants to explain everything in terms of the brain, and I'm thinking, but again, like, there's this fundamental problem is like, that matter is impermanent in the physical human body, like, there's something that is consistent, which is not material, or which is not...
Yeah, that organizes the material fields. Exactly.
Fields of intelligence, and I mean, if there wasn't this incredibly sophisticated tradition in the mystical and esoteric teachings about the chakras and about the importance of prana and just, you know, the practical demonstrations that people have given it of their mastery of the physical body and the intelligence of the physical body. And again, going back to Gurdjieff, the idea that we have these different brains in our centers of intelligence within our physical body, which govern various aspects of our being. It all points to me, like, that you've got to go beyond the physical, and that there are these huge, there's this huge need for, like, a rethinking of conventional biology and the realization of that.
Then, of course, it
raises all these other questions, like you say, about the whole history of the evolution of the species, which is fascinating. So, that'd be really interesting. I was going to say, I hope you're going to live another 30 years, so...
Oh, I said another 3 years.
No, 30.
Oh, yeah.
It might take you 30 to figure this one out. I don't know. You know?
Yeah. It's such a complex book. It was so beyond me the first time. But, you know, I mean, I was realizing I studied the volume one of The Secret Doctrine. I began in earnest in 1984, so it was like 25 years of trying to grasp that.
Yeah.
I'm so pleased. In fact, I did want to mention, and we need to bring the show to a close because we only have a few minutes here. I'm so taken by some of the recent kind of insights I've had into the cosmogenesis of The Secret Doctrine. And over the next three shows, I want to make a consistent effort. In the second half, I'm going to try to explain mystical creation according to The Secret Doctrine and the stanzas of Zan. And I'm going to go through the stanzas and actually try to explain this is Blavatsky's view of mystical creation. And I want to do that over 3 weeks. And so we'll take the last hour for the next three shows to try to go through some of that. And one of the reasons, because what I came to as I studied it more this time is that there are all different hypotheses I think we can derive from the secret doctrine, and I want to bring those up, what those are, because it leads to definite predictions, and I want to share some of those.
That sounds
so
great.
That'll be in the weeks ahead. Okay, well, thanks, James, and we'll see you tomorrow. You're going to be visiting, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thank you, BBS Radio.
Yeah, thanks.
And I'd like people to visit my website at zeropoint.ca and buy The Heart Doctrine. This is a beautiful and profound book, and it deserves to be widely read. And it's very timely, I think, in terms of what's happening in the world situation, that we need to have a new empowering and enlightening model of the nature of human existence and what we are as beings. Okay, thank you all, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Okay, goodbye. Bye.